It's time!
Hey, Dave, listen up, please.
Sometimes a warrior just has to kind of lay down on the ground for a minute, just stay there for a second and have a good bleed.
But what are you waiting for?
I don't know, something amazing.
Matt, for maybe the win.
Gafford, buckle up!
Welcome into the basketball podcast of Mid-America. As always, Seth Campbell going to be joined alongside Scotty Bordelon, the amazingly intelligent Scotty Bordelon, numbers analysis Scotty Bordelon, and one of my favorite. I think quotes that came from answers. You were from somebody's favorite analyst.
Yeah, that's what Dudley told me the other day. That makes me feel so great.
It should.
Gives me a warm feeling inside.
It should, Scotty. It really should. All right.
Shout out to that guy in Fort Smith.
Hey, we reach all parts of the state and the world, really, here on WholeHogSports.com.
Maybe he knows my name from my time covering Northside.
There you go.
Right out of college. Maybe that's it. Maybe he's followed along. So in that regard, thanks.
You're taking the Stephen A. Smith route, right?
I don't know about that.
Stephen A. always talks about
Smith, I don't know that I'm loud enough for that.
That is very true.
I think everybody in the media group can kind of attest to that. Not really loud enough.
The opposite Stephen A. Smith route then. Maybe you could be the anti
Stephen B. Smith.
Okay. Anyway, we got off topic there, but I mean, what do you expect from us?
Been a quick turnaround since Wednesday night.
It has been, but Arkansas coming out with a 99-90 victory over LSU. They came out and we said in the last podcast that Arkansas's first half against Tennessee was the best first half that they played all year. I think Arkansas won up to themselves in the first half against LSU.
Beautiful basketball in the first half. You end up scoring. Arkansas ends up putting up 55 points, and I think I saw this stat. What was it? Texas A&M. So LSU, the game before they came to Arkansas, went to Texas A&M, right? And they scored 50 points.
Yeah.
Texas A&M scored 50 points for the entire game. And going into the final 30 seconds of the first half, Arkansas had 51. And then...
That's insane.
Yeah, it was nuts. And then Mason Jones put together just another masterpiece of scoring the ball. He finished with 36, I think, on 10 of 17 shooting. Got to the line a lot. And just a little side note for a second, I checked KenPom this morning. He now leads the country in fouls drawn per 40 minutes at 8.1. He's finally edged the kid from Cal State Northridge. But Mason capped the first half just kind of in a perfect way. Like he scored 20 in the first half, and in the last, you know, 5 or 10 seconds, shot fakes a LSU defender on the perimeter, gets him to, you know, kind of bite on that shot fake, drew contact, and then got a three to go.
That was really impressive.
It was really unbelievable. Like the reaction from the crowd when that happened was awesome. And Mason was just otherworldly.
But that's almost what we've come to expect from Mason. Yeah. I thought that your question that you asked in the post game to Jimmy Witt, to Eric Musselman about, is this what you've come to expect? And Brotherman basically like, yeah.
Yeah. Jimmy was like, no, this is just kind of a normal thing for anybody that comes in and watches Arkansas play. You know, I guess he gave Tulsa, 41 back in December. And so like these scoring outbursts they're not new, but they're almost like he's taking it to another level where it's like Jimmy and Mus said, like it's almost becoming routine. And he's got a couple of 30-point games in Arkansas's last three games. And yeah, so he went for 37 against Tennessee, a slight 26 against Georgia, where I thought he played one of his more efficient games. He obviously didn't shoot the three very well, but he had 5 assists that game. And then he goes for 36, and he finally, like, he's finally shot the three really, really well. Like, he finished 4 of 6. Those four made threes are his most since he hit 5 against Auburn back on February 4th. So he had it all going. And then there was a stretch in the game where he was just getting to the rim at will. And the thing is, I wrote this on Wednesday night after the game, Mason missed 3 layups. And so he easily, like, he just makes those layups. He's got 3 40-point games for the year, and he kind of vaults himself into even more rarefied air. But, I mean, you can't knock a single thing, really, that he did against LSU.
Yeah, and him and Joe were the only ones that were actually good from the free throw line, too. That's another thing that if you think about, Arkansas scored 99 points, and they missed 8 free throws in a row. That's not just total how many free throws. They missed 8 in a row.
Yeah, must say they could have scored 112, 113. I think that's easy.
I mean, they shot 66% from the line. Now, they shot 54 free throws, which Will Wade was a little upset about, but they only made 36 of them. You got to make, like, think about it. You make 10 more of those, you've got 109 easily. And yeah, that's about the percentage you want to shoot there.
Yeah, and Arkansas missed 5 layups on top of the 18 missed free throws. So maybe you take half of those missed free throws away, that's 9, and then, you know, you're not going to be perfect around the rim always, but, you know, you make 3 more, so you take 9 and 6, 15. So yeah, you're pushing 115 points, and it came easy, which is the crazy thing. But I was telling you kind of I think it was right around halftime when you look up at the scoreboard, Arkansas put up 55. LSU, according to KenPom's, got the best offensive efficiency rating in the conference. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, it's almost 114 points per 100 possessions on average. And their defense has been awful. And Will Wade said as much too. He said, you know, after the game, he got asked if, you know, he's ever had a team that's committed, what, they finished with 34, 35 fouls. If he'd ever had a team foul that much, he was like, no, we're actually, like, coming into the game, we fouled the least of any team in the SEC. Well, he was like, that's about the only thing that we do well defensively. But when they're fouling, their defense is just, it's really bad. Like, yeah. I think next to last in the SEC in terms of defensive efficiency. And that was going in, into Wednesday's game. Let me check on their numbers now.
And
they're still 13th, but I mean that figure is 110.5, which is not good.
Yeah, no. And it's crazy to think about from this game in particular, because Arkansas didn't start off hot. They didn't start off making shots and coming out of the gates 90-0. That I wrote down here, Scotty, with, let's see, Arkansas went 3:55 in the first half. With and going over 4 from the field, but they went 3 minutes and 55 seconds without a bucket, with 11:35 left to go in the first half. Arkansas was 2 of 10 from the field, and all two of their makes were from beyond the arc.
Yeah, from Desi.
They came off
the bench after about, I think he checked in a little bit under 3 minutes into the game.
Yeah, so they were not hitting shots, but they were getting to the free throw line.
Yeah, Jimmy got fouled, I think, on a couple of mid-range jumpers. I think he hit, I think, 3 or 4 at the line, but that was it until Desi checked in.
Yep, and they were able to get to the free throw line, make some shots there, and get into the flow of the game. This is kind of crazy to think about, especially when they scored, what, 50? How many did you say they scored
55.
In the first half? 55. When you score 55 in the first half, but to say this, they kind of got off to another slow start in the first half, but their defense was able to shut them down. That's also something I want to talk about here in a second here, Scotty. That's another tease. But their defense was able to keep them in the game, and then they just exploded. And offensively, they have been better. Even in the loss to Georgia, they are scoring a ton of points recently, ever since Isaiah Joe came back, and Ethan Henderson has stepped up.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Arkansas's KenPom page and you go to their game plan, and it gives you like a breakdown of like offensive efficiency, defensive efficiency, their turnover rate, which their turnover rate against LSU was its lowest of the season. I think it was like 6%, which is remarkable. The only turnover Arkansas had in the first half was Desi Sills picked up his dribble, I think, on the left wing, and Javonte Smart just kind of swiped and went the other way and got a layup. But that was it.
One turnover.
Yeah, that was it in the first half.
Which is obviously their lowest.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, the ball movement in the first half was was beautiful, and the crowd recognized that. Like, there was a sequence where the ball just, I mean, it flipped sides of the floor, you know, two or three times, and then Isaiah Joe found Ethan Henderson right around the rim. He didn't finish at the rim, but he got fouled and I think split a pair of free throws. But that, I mean, you go back since in the five, I think Isaiah's been back five games now, I believe. I think Arkansas has posted like of its top five offensive efficiency nights of the season, three of those games are in the five games that Isaiah has been back. And I don't think that's a coincidence. Like, having a guy like him back, you know, just creates so much more space and opportunity for everybody else. And the thing I wanted to note too is that Arkansas scored 99 points and Isaiah Joe hit one shot.
Right.
And the one shot that he did hit was from the right corner, where he is, I mean, we've talked about it before, like, he has struggled mightily from there. I think when he hit that shot, I think he was 5 of 31 from the right corner, and then like a possession or two later, he missed one from there. But it's kind of crazy. He made one shot, Arkansas scored 99 points, and that one shot came from a spot on the floor where it's been pretty rough for him in that one area. But, you know, anytime you can get Mason Jones going for 36, and then Jimmy Witt turned in his best scoring night, I think, since the beginning of February, like, that's going to lift your efficiency numbers. And then Desi Sills goes 4 for 8, gives you pretty good play in 35 minutes. He was a team best plus 11, so continues to just be dynamite off the bench.
Yeah, he had a subdued game almost by his standards from coming off the bench in the last few. But he, like I said, like you said earlier, Scotty, he was the only one that hit field goals in the first 10 minutes of the game, basically.
Those were deep threes too, boy, like 3 or 4 feet beyond the arc.
This is a guy that started off the year 0 for 17 beyond the arc. That's insane that he's now a guy that you trust to pull up and hit your first three-pointers of the game. He has been so vital off of the bench, and I think that's a fantastic role for him.
Yeah.
But we would be remiss if we didn't talk more about a guy playing what could be his last game at Bud Walton Arena with a really weird story in Jimmy Witt. I'm going to spare you the story, because if you're listening to this podcast, you know the announcers for every single game have told you that, you know,
it's the same thing as like Mason Jones used to be a chunky boy. Like, it's that same.
We never made the drinking game.
Right. We should have. Maybe we'll do that before the SEC tournament.
Yeah.
We'll do an emergency pod before emergency Arkansas plays.
We'll have to think about the rules and the drinking game rules if Arkansas in the SEC tournament. But yeah, those are definitely two of the ones that you definitely have to drink. But Jimmy Witt with a double-double coming in his last game at Bud Walton Arena. Just a fantastic night from him. I mean, his assist numbers are great as well, which Scotty will get to in a second. But really, from Jimmy, just an all-around great game.
It was pretty awesome to see Jimmy go out and have the night that he did. And I could kind of tell early on, you know, because we mentioned earlier that he got fouled on a couple of mid-range jumpers, like in the first few minutes of the game. And that was basically all the offense Arkansas had before Desi checked in. You could tell that he was almost like, I think I'm going to try to just kind of get going in these early couple of minutes. And I didn't think he forced it either, but he got to his spots whenever he wanted. And Will Wade said after the game, for whatever reason, LSU cannot defend him, because he went for 22 against LSU in Baton Rouge, and then he goes for 26, 15 rebounds, which is a career high, and then 5 assists. Will Wade said that he controlled the game. Like, Mason Jones was obviously out of this world good, scoring 36, but Jimmy controlled the game, you know, getting to his spots, and LSU lost him, you know, in half court several times, didn't box him out, which led to what he said was probably the number one play of his career, when he, you know, had that monster tip slam.
He's been trying for those all year, by the way.
He has.
I remember one against Kentucky, and I think one against Auburn, where he's trying to put a tip slam back in, and he finally got one.
Yeah, he said that was 100% the best play that he's had in his career. He said he felt it. And Jimmy, you know, if you watch Arkansas regularly, you know that Jimmy's kind of a cool customer. Like, he doesn't really let his emotions show all that often. But JT Wampler got like probably the best shot, best picture of Jimmy that we've gotten of him all season. Like he let out a battle cry type scream after that slam. And he was like, yeah, I felt that one. It was like everybody in the building did, including the rim. Like that was a big time. That was a big time play from him.
They broke the rim. Or the net, I guess, is really what they broke. And it wasn't off of the tip slam dunk either. But there was a nice little delay to fix the net in the game, which just added to the weirdness of this Arkansas-LSU game.
Yeah, for a second, just talking about Jimmy, like he was so great with 26 and 15. He controlled the game, you know, kind of on the defensive glass. And that's an area I wrote in my, you know, the live updates, I always do those pregame notes and whatnot. The number one question that I had going into last night was, can Arkansas kind of hold its own on the glass after that rebound margin in Baton Rouge was minus 29? Arkansas, in large part to Jimmy and six rebounds from Ethan Henderson, who we got to talk a little bit more about later, Arkansas was only minus 5 on the glass, which was fantastic. Like if you stay within 5 of the, I think they're top 10 in the country in offensive rebounding rate. I mean, that's gonna keep you in a game and give you a good shot to win. Jimmy's also got 15 assists in his last three games. Going back to, I think since the turn of 2020, so since the start of conference play, in the first 15 games of 2020, Jimmy had 16 assists. The last three games, he's got 15. And so I asked him about that. And you know, the two games before Arkansas played LSU, you know, his jumper wasn't exactly working for him. And I think he understood it kind of in the same vein as, you know, when Mason was kind of struggling with his shot kind of early in conference against Vanderbilt and Ole Miss, when I think he had 16 or 17 assists in those two games, which was fantastic. But yeah, he went a combined 4 of 11 from the floor against Georgia and Tennessee, but he finished with 10 assists in those two games. And then against LSU, he goes for 5 more. And that's just a guy that knows how to make winning plays. That's just it's a crafty veteran who understands that, you know, he can get to his spots when he wants to, but when he can't, you know, he draws so much attention that it opens up things for other guys. And I'm going to go back. I'm planning on writing about Jimmy's assist numbers because they have spot, like going from 16 and 15 games to 15 and 3 games. I mean, that's a huge spike for him. I'm going to write about that probably later in the week.
So if you're listening to this podcast,
yeah, I'm definitely, I'm going to do an assist map for Jimmy too, because I want to know where those assists are going to. Just kind of like that map that I made for Mason, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah. One of Mason's, okay, you got me off topic. Well, if you're looking for Jimmy's, or Scotty's column about Jimmy's assist and you're listening to this, you know, a day or two later, it's probably up because Scotty does the,
Yeah, I'll be writing it on Thursday.
So, yeah, so it'll be up. So make sure to look for that if you want to go find that on wholehogsports.com. Also, Mason was trying to break your assist chart by getting one from half court.
Oh, my gosh. Unbelievable court vision.
He threw one from half court to the corner. And was it Sills that came out with the three-pointer? I'm trying to think.
Where was that? That was for a right corner three?
Yes.
I think that was for Isaiah. It was the one Isaiah's. That he hit, yeah. This isn't a great corner shooting team, so they don't take a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like you remember those shots vividly when they do take them.
But Mason Jones with the assist from half court, and Scotty looked at me and during the game said, I'm going to have to draw an extra line in my diagram just to see. He's going to have to come from off of the page.
Yeah, no kidding.
With that assist.
That was an unbelievable pass. And then he made another one from the perimeter where he just kind of whipped a two-hand pass to Ethan Henderson. And I think I'm going to have to pull up this tweet that I had the other day. Mason has assisted, I think, in February, he assisted on 14 threes. And I think 12 of them came on the left side of the floor, which Mason always operates. He tends to always operate on the left side of the floor. So it wasn't like a huge surprise. But he also assisted on, I think, 12 shots that resulted in scores in the lane or at the rim, which is, that's phenomenal. That's phenomenal. And he had another one of those to Ethan Henderson. And I think I think he had 4 or 5 assists where he was on the perimeter and he assisted to someone in the lane for a score. And he did that with Ethan Henderson against LSU. And Mason's just, there's some people out there, I know it as I hear it, that think that Mason, you know, is a little bit too ball dominant, which if you're ball dominant, sometimes you get called a ball hog. But Mason led the team in assists in February too, on top of scoring a career best 25.6 points a game. So how are you going to knock him?
Why would you knock him?
Yeah, you can't.
This is working extremely well for Arkansas right now with Isaiah Joe back. And, you know, we talked about Joe for a little bit, so I'm not going to belabor this point, Scotty, but Joe is on the floor for 38 minutes. And like we said, you know, if Joe hits one shot, you're not thinking that Arkansas scoring 99 points, one field goal, that Arkansas scoring 99 points, but they did. But I just think that that shows how crucial Joe is to this team by playing 38 minutes, only making one field goal, but he's allowing the offense to open up. Guys can't pack the lane anymore and try and stop Jimmy Witt whenever he drives because he's not a threat from the outside. They can't play off on the left side and help off of their post defender when Mason Jones drives to the lane because there's not a threat on the outside to shoot. Now there is that threat on the outside to shoot. Isaiah Joe is out there. So if you help off on Mason Jones, Mason has shown the ability to find Isaiah Joe and shoot the three. So Isaiah's literally his presence out there makes this team different. I think we know that, but just to sit there at the stats and say, oh my goodness, Joe only hit one field goal. Yes, but he still played 38 minutes. And he basically allowed for Mason Jones to go for 36, allowed for Jimmy Witt to go for 26.
Even if he went 1 for 7 against LSU, even if he was like 0 for 8, teams are still not going to leave him. You know what I mean? So it still leaves that extra gap open for guys to create plays. And I wanted to ask Mus about this because you and I talked about it kind of early in the game. I thought Isaiah kind of set the tone defensively. But there was, you know, really not enough time, and we get Mus the next day to preview Texas A&M. But I thought Isaiah, like I said, set the tone defensively. He was really physical around the rim and did an unbelievable job boxing out LSU's forwards. And there was one play where Isaiah is boxing out, I think it was either Trendon Watford or Emmett Williams, and he gets his hand on a rebound, does a great job boxing out, grabs a rebound right under the rim. Ethan Henderson kind of knocks him out of bounds. Mus is not upset. He kind of walks from about where he was kind of standing in front of the seat that he sits in. He walked almost to the baseline where Isaiah, just a few feet away from where Isaiah was getting up off the floor. And he was like, great job, Isaiah, great job. Like, he was great. Like, he blocked, I think, Javonte Smart's floater on LSU's first possession. He took 2 charges. He took one on Skylar Mays, and he took one on Emmett Williams, which, more power to you if you want to stand in front of Emmett Williams and take a charge. But he did it. He boxed out great, and then he drew a foul on Marlon Taylor that led to a couple free throws. Isaiah, like, Eric Musselman retweeted a video of Doc Rivers talking about Patrick Beverley the other night. Patrick Beverley did not score for the Clippers, but he finished the game a plus 13. And Doc Rivers talked about, you know, any young guy that may be watching, you need to keep your eyes on Patrick Beverley because he's not scoring at all, but his energy that he brings to the floor, the grit, the toughness, just the little things, the dirty work that helps teams win. That's what Patrick Beverley brings. And Isaiah, I don't want to say Isaiah was being Patrick Beverley, obviously, but Isaiah did those types of things. Like, obviously rebounding was a huge, like, the rebounding battle was going to be a huge deal in this game. And Isaiah obviously took the game prep, the game plan, and, you know, Arkansas kind of getting back to their training camp basics where they're boxing out all the time. He took that to heart, and he set the tone for Arkansas defensively. They were awesome on the glass.
And another guy that really helped out in the second time around against LSU that has been making the difference here recently, you have to talk about Ethan Henderson and the job that he's doing. Jimmy and Mason, both in the post-game interview, both said this, that the more and more he's out there, the more and more he's getting more comfortable. And you can almost tell that from the way in his mannerisms and the way he's playing the game. He looks more confident in himself. Now, he needs to get back to the free throw line, and whenever he's fouled, he needs to make more shots. He's shooting, what, roughly 50% from the line. But
yeah, he's at in conference play, he's 43% for the season. He's at 40%.
Yeah, so you would like for him to shoot a little bit better from the free throw line, but it's kind of weird to think about this, but we're almost to the end of the season. We're one game away from the end of the season, but it's still like the main starters, the Desi Sillses, Jimmy Witts, Mason Jones, when Harris comes into the game, it's still like they're trying to figure out how to play with Henderson because he hasn't played that much. Sure. It kind of reminds you of some of the earlier games against maybe like a Northern Kentucky, which was early in the season. They're trying to figure out how to play with each other because there was two turnovers in the second half where Arkansas went back-to-back possessions trying to get the ball to Ethan down low. And one time Ethan was looking for a lob and a dunk, and they threw it down low, and the ball went out of bounds. And so there's this chemistry there that you can almost tell that Ethan hasn't played 30 games this season. Sure. like everybody else has. But that's okay. He's the fresh guy off the bench. He's giving you quality minutes, and he's giving you rebounds, which is something that Arkansas desperately, desperately needed.
For sure. And I think you made a good point about just trying to figure out how to maneuver offensively with him on the floor. Is going into Wednesday, according to this Hoopland subscription that I've got, which gives you great lineup, which has a lineup selection tool where you can figure out how many possessions offensively and defensively, like any pair of players, three players, four players, five players have played together. Arkansas starting five going into the LSU game had only played 41 possessions together, which is Adriel, Isaiah, Jimmy, Mason, and Ethan. So obviously there's still some newness there. But I think you just tell Ethan to just, you know, offensive rebound when you can. And he's done a great job of that. I mean, I think over the last, you know, in the last three games, he's got six offensive rebounds.
Which is fantastic.
Which is great. Yeah, he was awesome against Tennessee. He had four offensive rebounds, had nine total rebounds for the game. He's been a plus on the offensive glass at times, and got some stick backs. And I think his offense obviously is going to come, you know, just through plays like all the attention is on Mason, so they leave him kind of unattended.
That happened when he got an easy dunk.
Yeah, yeah, he had two dunks against LSU, and I think both were kind of in those instances. And another was, you know, Mason's running pick and roll, and two or three guys just like kind of gravitate to him, and Ethan's just kind of like, hey, I'm under the rim. Y'all want to guard me? If you don't want to guard me, cool, I'm going to dunk it.
Yeah.
He had a couple of those plays. He's just, his energy has been awesome. And Will Wade was like, we were not surprised at all that Ethan played, started, and had an impact on the game. He, you know, John Fulkerson went absolutely, he went off at Kentucky the other night. Ethan Henderson probably guarded him about as well as anybody has over the last couple of weeks. So Ethan's playing with some great energy, and it's good to see him. You know, he's played 27 plus minutes in two of the last three games after, you know, he didn't play more than eight before the calendar turned to 2020. So props to Ethan. He's playing with a lot of energy, a lot of passion, I think. And, you know, the spark that he's kind of brought to the starting lineup is getting this team off to a little bit better starts.
So, Scotty, without looking at the roster and the stats that are in front of you, so we're going to move on and talk about just a few other guys before we talk some big picture stuff here. Without looking at the stats that are in front of you, who was tied for the second highest plus minus on the Arkansas Razorbacks yesterday?
I mean, maybe Ethan?
So, number one.
I know Desi was number one.
Number one is Desi Sills. Number two, there was a tie between Jimmy Witt.
Isaiah.
Mm-mm.
Mason.
Mm-mm.
Ethan.
Mm-mm.
Reggie Chaney.
Yes. Reggie Chaney had a plus minus a seven, which was tied for Jimmy Witt as the second highest on the team. Isaiah had six and Mason had four plus minus. But Chaney only playing, what did he play? He got in the game 6 minutes. So he was in the game 6 minutes with a plus minus is plus minus a seven. He got, I mean, it was a rare appearance as of recently for Reggie, but I mean, he showed that he's got some, I don't know what the right word is, but he's working through whatever has been kind of holding him back, and he looks maybe to be on the up and up. And Arkansas has the, I guess it's the luxury of not having to play him or Harris that much here recently, because they've had Ethan Henderson step up, and that's allowed for one less spot in the rotation. And I know that those guys don't think that it's a luxury at all, but for Musselman, that gives guys that aren't getting minutes. Right? They don't have to play all the time. I mean, Adriel Bailey has played 14 minutes yesterday. Ethan took the bulk load of this, and that's good for this team because the rest of the team has been taking the bulk of the minutes while Ethan was on the bench. So I think this team will be better. And if they want to make a run in the SEC tournament, which I think they're going to have to win at least one game, maybe two, if they really want to get to that NCAA tournament, they're probably going to need some of these guys playing back-to-back games.
For sure. And I thought Reggie was really solid in his 6 minutes. You know, he hasn't played more than eight since the Mississippi State game. I think Florida, he played five. Missouri, he got five. Tennessee, eight. Georgia, he only played 2 minutes. And, you know, just kind of got violently turned away at the rim, which wasn't great. And he didn't see the floor after that. But 2 points in 6 minutes, had an offensive rebound. And one of the things I really like, too, I think Reggie is a really, really underrated interior passer.
Oh, that was a sick assist.
He put a little bit of – there was some flair on that no-look assist to Jimmy Witt for a dunk. And Reggie just continues to impress me in that regard. That was his first assist since, according to KenPom, since the Tennessee game on the road where he had two. When Arkansas was at Missouri, I think he got shorted a couple of assists, and one of them led to a dunk from Adriel Bailey. Reggie's just, I think that's another aspect of Reggie's game that I think gives him the potential. Obviously, every game Mus is going to play based on matchups. Like, Reggie may not play just a whole lot against Texas A&M. I figure he might because Josh Nebo is like a 6'10", 240-pound problem. But that interior passing and, you know, guys like Jimmy Witt who like to play in that dunker spot, or Adriel Bailey in the dunker spot, those guys are beneficiaries of Reggie's vision. And I really liked the 6 minute run that he gave Arkansas.
Do you have anything else you want to say about any guy specific before we move a little bit big picture here?
I don't think so. Just going back to Ethan for a second, I think it was awesome for him to get those two dunks, and then he also finished an and one at the rim. So he was 3 of 3 at the rim against LSU. That was really good to see, because in February he was 6 of 13 at the rim, which you obviously need him to finish a little bit better than that. And so he was 6 out of 13 last month. 3 of those makes came against Florida. So you take the Florida game away, he was 3 of 9 at the rim. So I think that 3 of 3, you know, just at point blank range, I think that was a big deal for him.
Yeah, that can't do anything but increase his confidence.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Something, if you've watched the Razorbacks all season long, that you might have noticed here recently is Arkansas had not allowed double-digit three-point makes all season long. And then they allowed 10 against Florida. They allowed 10 against Georgia. Georgia went 10 and 23. And then all of a sudden you look at LSU, and LSU also made double digits, where I believe they had
11. Yep.
11 of 27. I think we saw why. And Musselman alluded to it. They've switched their defense a little bit.
Yeah, they're pick and roll coverage for sure.
With Henderson in the game, they've switched pick and roll coverage, and they're not giving up as much inside. They feel like they can get better rebounding, and I think they haven't gotten out-rebounded by as much if you took an average since they've switched over their pick and roll coverage, but it has cost them a little bit on the three-point line.
Yeah, a little bit. I think that's, like Chad Morris used to say, like, by design.
Yeah.
Mus alluded to it. They switched up their pick and roll coverage, I think, going into the Missouri game at home. And, you know, Missouri's obviously not a not a great three-point shooting team, and Tennessee's not that great either. Those two teams combined to hit, you know, 8 of 38. But Georgia's obvious – Georgia – Arkansas just – I think the Georgia game, the 10 threes that they hit, that was just kind of a – it's kind of a lack of awareness of shooters on the floor. You know what I mean? Because Muss talked about it in his post-game radio interview with Chuck Barrett. Tyree Crump came off the bench and hit, I think, 4 or 5 threes. And Muss was like, everybody who scouts games or watches any Georgia games at all know that, you know, Tyree Crump is a pretty good three-point shooter. The recognition just wasn't there. I mean, late in that Georgia game, I thought when Tyree Crump hit probably the biggest shot of the game to kind of give Georgia some separation late, he catches on the right wing, and Jalen Harris thinks that Anthony Edwards traveled, like, in penetrating into the lane. And so Jalen's, like, looking at Anthony Edwards and an official kind of all at once, and he's, like, doing the traveling violation sign with his hands. And Tyree Crump was Jalen's matchup. And so – it's just recognition on the three-point line. You got to get out to shooters. Like, the awareness has to be a little bit better, and it wasn't in that game, and that really hurt them. You know, Anthony Edwards also just hit some really tough shots against Arkansas. Like, I was kind of surprised that he didn't try to get to the rim more, but he had his jumper working. So, I mean, whatever, more power to him. He's taking tough long twos, contested threes. Sometimes good offense beats – solid defense. You just kind of got to tip your hat to him. He's a special talent. But Skylar Mays too was pretty solid from three. I think he hit four threes against Arkansas on 7 attempts. And I think Arkansas just kind of at a certain point was like, once LSU got into foul trouble and like Javonte Smart picked up 2 or 3 fouls, brought him off the floor, LSU had to bring in a guy named James Bishop. You ever heard of him?
No.
So what do you think they do? They leave him.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever was assigned to say, I got to keep looking at his name because I keep forgetting what his first name is. Whoever's matched up on James Bishop left to go soft trap the ball handler. And Arkansas was more than happy to live with James Bishop taking, I mean, he took, see how many shots he took. He took 9.
He was 3 of 9, but 1 of 5 from 3.
Yeah. I mean, he took 9 shots in 15 minutes. So in the 15 minutes he was out there, that little strategy tweak was effective.
Of 2 notes that I made were the press, the trap, the soft trap. I like that word. The soft trap that they used resulted in at least 2 turnovers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so, there was one where – it may have been Bishop or it could have been Skylar Mays or Javonte Smart, but he threw a pass into the scorer's table.
Yep. I mean, just overshot everybody. So I would say that was a smart move, which Eric Musselman has made just a few of those this
Trendon
year.
Watford also got called for traveling once, too, yes, after he caught at the free throw line because he wasn't sure. I think he understood when he caught that the defender who was between him and the rim at that point, right after he caught, I think he felt like he had a matchup advantage, but he also out of the corner of his eye saw Bishop standing over there in the corner. So it's like, what do I do? Feet are kind of, you know, discombobulated a little bit and resulted in a turnover.
All right, got to touch on this real quick before this is going to be the last podcast that we produce before the SEC tournament, and it may be the last. Scotty, when exactly is Player of the Year stuff announced? It's before the SEC tournament.
Yeah, that'll come out, I think, early next week.
So we will probably not have a podcast before then. So before end of season's awards are awarded, is there any doubt that Mason Jones is SEC Player of the Year now?
I mean, there's a little bit of doubt, but I mean, if just in general, I think there's a little bit of doubt, but it's not because of anything Mason hasn't done. It's like Emmanuel Quickley is playing really, really well for Kentucky too. And I think the Player of the Year race is going to come down to Mason, Emmanuel Quickley, Nick Richards. You might can throw Samir Dowdy in there because Auburn's had a really good year. And then maybe Reggie Perry. Reggie Perry's averaging 17 and 10 for a team that's pushing 20 wins, may have 20 wins at this point. So, I mean, I asked Mus about how legitimate Mason's case is for Conference Player of the Year. He said he's not really worried about it, which is, I mean, I get that. I mean, there's still games to be played. And, you know, he was like, there's lots of good players on teams that are higher up in the standings than Arkansas is. But Mason just continually, night in, night out, just giving teams 25-plus, 30-plus on almost a nightly basis. I mean, he's got as compelling of a case as anybody in the league does.
Like, when you go against 40 against Tulsa, you're like, okay, that's cool. And then when you put up 30 against one or two SEC teams, you're going, okay, that's – I mean, that's he's a good scorer. He put up 30 in his sophomore season against – that was Florida. He put up over 30 against Florida in a loss. Like he has that capability. But then once he does it the fourth time in a season, the fifth time in a season, the sixth time in a season, it's all of a sudden, okay, all right, this is not a surprise. He's not taking any teams by surprise. They are game planning for Mason Jones, and Mason Jones is better than your game plan. When he goes for over 30 against Auburn without Isaiah Joe, come on.
Like, yeah, he goes for 40 that night.
Like, there's a point to where you start going from, oh, this is cool, to, oh, this Mason Jones kid has got it.
Yeah, I wrote on Monday after I asked Mus that question about Mason. I was like, I think my last couple lines of my story were Emmanuel Quickley and Nick Richards may very well win Conference Player of the Year. And they're, I mean, I don't think you could like get really like too up in arms about it, because Quickley's been great, especially down the stretch. Like he had a really good February, and February is where you really separate yourself as a Conference Player of the Year candidate, and that's a time when your team has to make a push too. Just you want to obviously want to build up some momentum going into March. So those two guys, you know, they're a big reason. Like they're two of the biggest reasons why Kentucky, you know, claimed the SEC regular season championship, and they won at Auburn doing it, or they won at home. They beat Auburn doing it. But all Mason did in February was, like I said earlier, scored 25.6 points a game and lead Arkansas in assists, set his teammates up for really high quality looks, and
over half of those not being without Isaiah Joe.
Exactly, yeah. And he was just, I mean, he was lights out. I think, like I said, I don't think you could go wrong with Quickley or Richards, but I think Mason, hands down, has been the story of the SEC season. And at this point, I think it's kind of a toss-up between Quickley and or Richards. And Mason, I think Mason just he's a walking bucket, dude. Like, and he's at this point, you know, with Isaiah being out for a good chunk of February, he's the reason that Arkansas is where it is now. And without Mason, this team would be in some dire trouble. But he's been the story of the SEC season for me. And like if I had a vote for SEC Player of the Year, Mason would get it. Absolutely.
Who does vote for that? Yeah, I don't know either. Okay. I'm just gonna make sure. What would your feelings be if Mason won co SEC Player of the Year?
That would be about par for the course.
Doesn't it seem like so?
He's won like co Player of the Week, like how many times? Two or three times?
Two or three. I think it's three, and I know for a fact twice. The last time this last week was with Quigley, and his, like, I get it. Quigley is winning games and Kentucky.
Yeah, he was like, Kentucky had a pretty rough night at Texas A&M. Like, they won, I think, by 9 points, but Quigley like hit 8 of 12 from three. Like that, like you can't ignore that.
Right. And I get it, but he also, I think Mason Jones outscored him by 8 points, had better stats rebounding. I don't know about assist wise, but it's just one of those things, man, where you just go, if Arkansas won four more games, I don't even think this is a conversation. Four more games in conference, I don't think this is a conversation.
You know, if Quickley does end up winning SEC Player of the Year, Mason is one. He's the absolute number one guy that he'll be at the top of the first team all SEC team.
Yeah, for sure.
Like that, I mean, there's no question about it. Like he's going to get rightfully recognized. Like I say that, like he might not win SEC Player of the Year, but he's going to be obviously honored for, you know, like what he's done this entire season. I don't think anybody's trying to shortchange him at all.
That's fair. And, you know, Musselman kind of wants him to win. He can say whatever he wants publicly, but it doesn't do anything but help your program when you have sure. a guy win SEC Player of the Year and you can sell other recruits.
Yeah, you could sell that story. Absolutely. Even though Mason's not a guy that he brought in, like that's still a story that you can sell to recruits for sure.
Yeah, this guy became SEC Player of the Year with the help of my staff and me and the development process that we went through.
Being around Mason this year, like he's – like. Mus obviously had a plan for Mason coming into the season, but I mean, Mus has seen Mason work throughout this entire offseason throughout the entire year. He can be like, this is what Mason Jones did. If you don't know Mason's story, lost a bunch of weight, dedicated himself to his game, worked tirelessly, and just kind of grew up right before our eyes. And you can do this. You can do this, like if you set your mind to it, just kind of follow the Mason Jones path.
The Mason Jones plan, reminds me of what some guys at Arkansas baseball have been doing during summer following the Andrew Benintendi plan, which is not playing summer baseball and deciding to just lift weights and stuff. All right, last thing let's talk about before we end this basketball podcast of Mid-America. It is March, which means conference tournaments and NCAA tournaments are upon us. Scotty, they're quickly approaching. There's only one game left in the SEC regular season. And with an advanced mathematics degree, I think I have figured out the tiebreakers and where Arkansas can and cannot be. It takes an advanced mathematics degree.
I'm ready for you to explain it to me because it's too complicated for me.
Oh, boy. All right. So here's what I got. Arkansas right now, if you look at the standings, they are sitting at 7-10 in conference, and they are 10th. So what you want to do, if you're Arkansas, is you want to not play on the first day.
Yeah, you want to avoid an 11-14, which Vandy's got the 14 wrapped up, and gosh.
Georgia got their 13 unless, hang on, who does Georgia
yeah,
play?
Yeah, so they play LSU at LSU on Saturday, so that's probably a loss for Georgia.
So you think that the 14 and 13 are pretty much wrapped up. Now, here is where it gets interesting, Scotty. If you go in and take care of business against Texas A&M, then nothing matters, okay? You have a locked up not playing on that first day. You've at least locked up the 10 seed. So if you take care of business and win at Texas A&M, that's the first thing that we need to get out of the way. You take care of business, you move to 8-10 in conference. The only team that you can possibly catch at this point is Alabama. A&M, even though you have a victory over them, they would be 9-9 in conference. So you cannot catch them. You'd be 8-10. You cannot catch Tennessee because if they lost, they would be 9-9 in conference. So the only team you can catch is Alabama, which is sitting at 8-9 right now. Alabama plays
at Missouri, I believe.
At Missouri. So here's where things get interesting, though. If you're Arkansas, this is kind of a lose-lose situation. So I'm trying to explain this the best I know how. Arkansas sitting at 7-10. If you win and Alabama loses, then you get the 9, okay? That's fine. Like I said, a lot of things get simplified if Arkansas wins. If Arkansas loses and they fall to 7-11, and Missouri beats Alabama, well, Alabama still remains that 9 seed. Then all of a sudden, if Missouri wins, there is a two-way tie for 10th between Arkansas and Missouri. And then if you really wanted to, you know, just to make things in for fun, sitting at 6-11 as well as Missouri is Ole Miss. Now, Ole Miss is kind of irrelevant in all of this because here's how the SEC does a three-way tiebreaker. Three-way tiebreakers go to record between the teams. So what's your record against the other teams? Missouri has a 2-1 record against the other teams between Ole Miss, Arkansas. So they've beaten Arkansas once, Ole Miss once, and lost Arkansas once. Arkansas has beat Ole Miss once, beat Missouri once, lost to Missouri once. So they both have a 2-1 record. So Ole Miss basically becomes irrelevant at this point. They're going to drop if these three teams are tied. Now you look at Arkansas and Missouri. So first things first, you go to head-to-head. They played twice. Arkansas-Missouri split. So then you go. This has been fascinating. We're not even halfway. This is all the possibility. Like I said, this just becomes super easy if you beat A&M. So then you go, if there is a two-way tie and the teams have the same record against each other, so they split, you go to their record versus the number one seed. The number one seed is Kentucky. Kentucky has lost or beaten both Missouri and Arkansas. They are 1-0 against Arkansas and 1-0 against Missouri. So that doesn't matter. So then you drop to the two seed. All right, Scotty, have you written all this down yet? Because we're still not done. Here's where things get interesting. Arkansas versus the two seed in the SEC tournament, and Missouri gets the two seed. Well, that's still left to be decided. There are three teams right now tied for the two seed at 11-6. Those teams are Auburn, LSU, and Florida. So get this, Missouri, who is now ranked 11th, right? They are 2-1 against those teams.
Wow.
Arkansas is 1-2. They beat LSU just recently.
Yeah.
And they lost LSU as well. So they don't have, actually that would mean that they were 1-3 against these teams. But that doesn't matter. If you're Arkansas, you need LSU to win and Auburn and Florida to lose if you wanted to win the tiebreaker in this, because that would mean that they are the two seed and Arkansas would have a better record because Missouri lost to LSU. So Arkansas would have a better record against the two seed. Meanwhile, if Florida or Auburn get the two seed, then Missouri has a better record against them than Arkansas does, and Missouri would get that higher seed. Now, that's just for Arkansas. If you want to, you can do this, what I just did, you can do all over again between Auburn, LSU, and Florida to see what their records are between each other and where they will rank out in seeding. You do all of that, and you can figure out what the likelihood is that who they will play. I did not do that. I got tired.
I understand. That was exhausting.
So, recap. Win. Arkansas wins, then they're guaranteed no lower than the 10 seed.
It always comes down to winning.
If they win, they could go all the way up to the 9 seed, guaranteed no lower than the 10 seed. You lose, you could drop to the 11, you could stay at the 10.
That was a great breakdown.
Holy crap.
Thank God you did that, because there's no way in the world I would have been able to process that and explain it the way that you did.
Holy, that is just...
Seth is sweating bullets.
Yes, I am. And I'm sitting here trying to figure out what I missed. And there's just... So, like I said, Kentucky's going to win. There's three teams tied for second. The good thing about all of that is, well, you know, okay. Well, those are probably going to be the teams with byes. But also at the same point, you know, if you just wanted to add in, there are two teams. Not only there are three teams sitting at 11-6, but there are two teams sitting at 10-7. So if somehow like those teams could get in the mix as well, so I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that you know that exactly that those four teams are going to be the teams that get the double byes, because the two teams sitting at 10-7 right now are Mississippi State and South Carolina, which South Carolina, wow. And then after those two teams, there's Tennessee and Texas A&M, both with tied with 9-8 records, then Alabama 8-9, then Arkansas 7-10.
Texas A&M may be the surprise of the league. Were they picked to finish last?
And they were playing like it in the non-conference.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they lost to, or they only beat Texas Southern by, just a couple points, I think, in the early stages of the season. Yeah, they beat Texas Southern 58-55 at home.
And they
also, they got their doors blown off by Gonzaga, which, whatever. That's going to happen.
Yeah.
They lost to Harvard, Temple, Fairfield, three straight games. And then you throw in kind of a – I mean, they beat Texas A&M Corpus Christi by three.
Yikes.
By three. And now, I mean –
they got a winning record in conference. If they beat Arkansas, they'll be 10-8.
And then on Wednesday night, they won at Auburn.
I think Auburn's a fraud.
I mean, yeah, but, I mean, you just don't go into Auburn and win, though.
That's fair.
I mean, they'd won 17 straight at home, but – Buzz Williams and them boys.
Hey.
I mean, they go in there, and I think Josh Nebo ends up having a really big night. He went for 19 points. He only finished with three rebounds, but I mean, he was 9 of 12 from the floor. They didn't have an answer for him. I think he could potentially be a big problem for Arkansas if Arkansas's front line doesn't play well on Saturday.
Literally a big problem.
Yeah, like he's literally a 6'9", 245 pound problem.
And I guess just to give you a heads up, if Arkansas somehow gets the 9 seed, they'll play the first game on Thursday at 11 Eastern, 11 Central. If they get the 10 seed, they won't play until 5 o'clock Central, 6 p.m. Eastern. And if they get the 11 seed, then they are playing the late game on Wednesday, which leads to the late game on Thursday. There's nobody's won the tournament starting in that first day. What's the farthest they've gone? I think the Final Four. I don't know if anybody's ever made the championship game since this tournament expanded to 14.
Who's that? Who played on Wednesday?
Yeah. Didn't Ole Miss make a big run?
Could have been.
That may have been, though, before 14 teams were in. I remember the Andy Kennedy and
Marshall Henderson
run that got them into the NCAA tournament. Anyway.
It was a blast from the past. Marshall Henderson was fun.
He was fun. Golly, he was fun. All right. I think we've done enough. What do you think, Scotty? My brain is tired. So
yeah, Seth is now laying on the floor. I just gave him a bottle of water. He's exhausted after that standings breakdown.
I feel like Mason Jones with Isaiah Joe out. I've had the team on my back here, and I'm ready for a break.
You deserve one, buddy.
All right. Well, for Scotty Borderline, make sure to check out his stuff online at wholehogsports.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at NWA Scotty. He'll tweet out all of his stories, so you can just go there and click on the links that he will tweet out to make sure that you can follow and keep up with Razorback basketball. Razorback basketball, they're in the first four out, so things are heating up right now. They might just make their way into the first time Arkansas has ever been in one of those play-in games, and so that would be fun.
That'd be awesome to go to Dayton.
That would be interesting.
Might run into Obi Toppin. That would set the trip over the top.
Yes, Obi Toppin. Anyway, you're getting me distracted again, Scotty. As I said, follow him online on Twitter. I feel like an old person there online. Follow him on Twitter at NWA Scotty. You can follow me on Twitter at SethCampbell5. This has been the Basketball Podcast of Mid-America. We will be back next week. We will preview the SEC tournament for you, give you some projections. But for Scotty Borderline, I'm Seth Campbell saying so long, and we'll see you back here next week. Hello, Basketball Podcast of Mid-America listeners. I wanted to put this in at the end of the podcast. As I was going back and listening through the podcast, I got really excited and slightly confused during the breakdown of all the scenarios at the end of the season. So I just wanted to recap. I did miss say something, and so I wanted to give that to you here for clarification. So, clarification. What I said wrong was that if Missouri and Ole Miss win and Arkansas loses, then that would go to a three-way tie. That would not, and that Ole Miss would become irrelevant because Missouri and Arkansas both have the same records against the teams that those three teams. That is not correct. What actually would happen is if there was a three-way tie between Arkansas, Ole Miss, and Missouri, Arkansas would be the one that we claim the 10 seed. So this works out in Arkansas's favor because Arkansas has a 2-1 record against those teams, while Missouri has a 2-2 record and Ole Miss has a 1-2 record. There was a game in there that I missed, so I wanted to come out and tell y'all about that. So disregard that. If there is a three-way tie between Ole Miss, Missouri, and Arkansas, then Arkansas will get the 10 seed. Other than that, everything stays the same. If you win, you stay the 10 seed at the least. You can move up to the 9 if Alabama loses. And then the only way you can really go down to that 11 is if Ole Miss loses, Missouri wins, and Arkansas wins. And then you go in to that tiebreaker scenario with the 2 seeds in the tournament. So if LSU gets the 2 seed, Arkansas would get the 10 seed. But if Florida or Auburn gets the 2 seed, then Missouri would get the 10 seed and Arkansas would drop to the 11. Sorry about the confusion. It's a little chaotic. I misspoke, so I wanted to come and tell y'all all about that. I really appreciate y'all listening to the podcast.